Well, hello and welcome to what is a new episode. And that's a rubbish start, isn't it? Yeah. Well, hello and welcome to the latest episode. Does that work? Of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and him,
Scott Cassin-Rennie, and our
Becky Brooks.
Way in the house. Way.
Hello.
Friend of the show. Oh, it's lush having you back, Becky. How are you doing?
I am not bad. I've got quite the cold. So if I break into like rhapsodic singing of Smelly Cat in a husky voice, you'll understand why. That, by the way, is a Friends reference. So anybody that's, you know, of a younger age than me might have no idea what I've just said.
Yeah. I was going to go with Tina Turner or like, Cleo, like something.
Oh, yeah.
Raspy.
Tina Turner. I'll take that.
So you're simply the best, Becky Brooks.
Oh, thank you.
Excellent. Well, it's like our biannual check in with Becky Brooks, where we get you at Christmas and we get you in the summer, and in the summer you tell us about the adoption barometer. So, but before we get into the adoption barometer, what's new in Becky's world?
Oh, nothing. I mean,
you're always guaranteed to have, you know.
Oh, yeah, I'm bringing all the excitement tonight. The thrill and the excitement. Yeah, it's all going on. Yeah, no, well, not a lot really. I still live where I live and I still do the job that I do, and I've been decorated. Is that interesting enough? Not really. My 11-year-old is having a newly decorated bedroom.
Oh.
It hasn't been decorated since he was three. And I thought it was quite tasteful, the original decoration, but he, anyway, so he's having it done in burnt orange and grey. So yes. Yes, ceilings as well. So
is that sunglasses?
Wow. You absolutely need eye protection when you go in. But I figured there's a little niggling, upset. You know, these little childhood things happen that they're not really very important, but you remember them for all of your life. When I was seven, we moved into a new home, and it was a big deal. It was our family home, our forever home kind of thing. And the decorating of my bedroom was done without any input from me, and I've never really got over it.
Oh, okay.
I know, right? And it was brown because this was the early 80s, late 70s maybe even. And I've never really got over that terrible loss from my childhood. So when the 11-year-old said he wanted his bedroom done in orange and black originally, and I did bring him round to grey, I was just like, okay, then. Yeah. But I did have this moment in B&Q when I was buying the orange and very dark grey paint, where it occurred to me he's essentially having his bedroom painted in the style of B&Q. Felt a bit weird buying the paint, but there we go.
Oh, you are top quality. My teenage daughter said she wanted all of the walls black, and we just... I'll be honest with you, we just said, no, it's not going to happen.
I think I would have drawn the line at that. Yeah. I mean, I've gone with the ceiling, but the trauma for me of it is... They have the orange ceiling that he wanted. I mean, he's really like,
wow.
I've done two coats. I've done like two coats of this orange paint, and you know, I think it needs another two coats. So it's just a never-ending bedroom painting scenario.
But you'll save on light electricity because you'll need light. There'll be the ambient light.
Sure.
In fact, you could probably, rent out electricity to other people.
Yeah, get some solar panels in there.
Yeah, exactly. You'd be sorted. I have to be honest. The black thing is I'm with that because Jacob has asked for that many times. I would rather he walked around with black eyeliner on. And that's what he does instead of the black wall. So, no, it's just not happening here either, to be honest. And the brown, I remember my bedroom carpet was dark brown. Dark, and I mean really dark brown. And I'll never get over that. Who the hell thought that dark brown carpets were a good idea in houses in the 70s and 80s? I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
Oh, I can remember being about 16 and my parents saying, oh, you can, if you want to decorate it, you can decorate. You can choose it, but you have to do it. And me being like, oh, yeah, that's great. And about 30 seconds in, realizing this was going to be the longest summer of my entire life.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's even finished yet. It was just an awful experience. Like the cheapest wallpaper you could buy, which is the hardest wallpaper to put up, electric blue. It was the 80s with like neon.
You have them flashes a thing through it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I remember
the height of taste.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, there you go. Wow. Mm. Who knew? People came for you and they stayed for the decor.
That's it. Oh,
and How's things at Adoption UK? I mean, I'm drawing you onto thin ice here. How's things going? Wait, have you got a new leader?
We do. Not yet. We are about to have. So they've appointed a new leader who is not is going to start sometime soon. I'm always terrible at these conversations because you know that I work at my kitchen table. So I, most of the time, I have very little idea what's going on in Adoption UK more generally. It would be fun if I could dish some dirt, but I never know any dirt. I don't know any. So yes, there is someone new coming. I will tell you the person's name, but I honestly can't remember it.
Let me down. The only reason I've stayed in touch with you is because I thought at some stage you would take over as this the kind of the weasel that went. No, I don't mean weasel.
Yeah.
Not the weasel. That sounds wrong. The nosy person.
I thought I was a weasel.
You could have been the nosy person to replace me and keep us up to date with all the gossip. And that's just ridiculous now, honestly.
I'm the least good person for that because I've got zero memory for names or faces. Most of the time when I'm speaking to somebody, I don't know who they are. I have a lot of these conversations. Well, Becky, it's so good to see you again. And I'm like, yeah, it's great to see you again. I don't no idea who you are. I'm sure announcements will be made, but I'm not sure when. But yes.
It seems to have been a while, like compared to last time.
Does it?
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem to be like a long time to be kind of plodding on your own. I mean, I know you've not been plodding on your own because I'm sure your chair of trustees has been guiding you and all that. But, you know, to not have an in-place CEO is quite a while.
I guess it seems like a big deal. But then again, I think, you know, I guess in that time we've done the barometer, which is probably one of the big things that we've done. And like, it's the fourth time we've done it. So we sort of vaguely know what to do now. You know what I mean? It's... some things can just go on, can't they? Yeah. I think. Yeah.
If your life was a film, would there just be this montage of you at the kitchen table with the seasons changing in the window behind that bit?
Yeah, and holding children at arm's length because they really, really need a snack right now. But I'm having a meeting with this person from the Department for Education, so I can't give you a snack. So, loads of that. But that's better than pre-COVID, because pre-COVID, before we all had Teams and Zoom and all of that, it would be me in the downstairs toilet holding the phone to my ear with my foot against the door, trying to keep the children out as I tried to have a private meeting with somebody on some kind of conference call. So this, the last 3 years have been a huge improvement on general
work. We're seeing behind the veil now, aren't we? There's nothing.
I actually remember when I worked at Adoption UK and being in a meeting, a conference call meeting with Becky, and she was actually in the downstairs toilet.
Many times.
And she said, I'm really sorry if I sound echoey and I might have to leave the call because I'm in my downstairs toilet.
If someone needs the downstairs toilet, then I may have to be moving.
Might have to evacuate.
Yeah. I'm sure I've told you this story. I did a meeting with I was doing a supervision with a student social worker, and my 15, yeah, she was 15 at the time, walked in backwards with a dress, topless, but backwards, with a dress around her waist, and said, "Oh, zip this up." And I was like, I'm going to lose my registration. She was, nothing could be seen, but unfortunately, the person I was supervising was a female. So, yeah, kids, man. Crazy.
No, right. We've got no idea.
No idea. Anywho, tell me about the adoption barometer, the last one last year, and there was a specific focus which has escaped my mind. I've had a very busy day. Has escaped my mind the last year. And then how did you then decide? Because you do the sort of the standard adoption barometer, but then you maybe focus it on something. How did you come to the focus? And tell us what the focus is of this year's barometer.
Right. So last year's focus was on transitions to adulthood.
Got it.
And
remember
that
now.
Do you remember now? And it just seemed like the ideal moment to get the views of adult adopted people, right? Because it was really something that really lent itself to that. And it would be something we've been talking about for a while around the barometer. And I think in a sense, the theme for this year, which was direct contact, almost arose out of that. because although the survey, the questions we were asking adopted adults last year were largely around the type of support that was available to them during the sort of teens and early 20s. And we were particularly looking at this transition from services for children to services for adults. What became very clear in that was that in many aspects, there are no services for adults. The transition is, it's a cliff edge because, you've stopped getting this support now, and now there's just nothing for you. And I think one of the areas that's, some of the stories that we heard were things like from both adoptive parents and adopted adults were around things like receiving support for maintaining contact until the age of 18 via letterbox, and then at the age of 18 being sent a letter saying, well, that's the end, bye, you know, just leaving everybody with like, well, what, wait, what, that's it. Yeah. And so really, so although the survey wasn't about that last year, a lot of that really came through. And I think in addition to that, you've been involved in some of it, that a lot of organisations are talking about and looking at contact at the minute. There was a report by PAWS. There's all the looking into updating how we do the sort of indirect contact, the letterbox style contact, and you know, whether that's fit for purpose, it isn't, and other things. I'm speaking of somebody who attempts to participate in it, it doesn't work well for us. There's a lot of talk about that. And I think the question that I was asking really to me, to myself, when we started thinking about what the in-focus topic would be, was along the lines of, there is a lot of talk about the importance of positively managed contact and well-supported contact and direct contact. And we've got some evidence of that working well through the barometer. And I feel there's an increasing openness towards people doing more of that, okay? But literally what happens if your, let's say, nine-year-old says, well, wait, but I really want to meet this birth relative or that birth relative that I'm currently writing letters to, who do you ring? Mm-hmm. You know, who helps you? When you ring them, what do they say to you? Do they say, oh, no, don't do that, it's terribly dangerous? Or, you know, do they actually support you to think through what's going to happen next? Is there any support? Do they help you set it up? Once they've helped you set it up, do they disappear into the wild blue yonder? Or do they hang around and check in with you periodically to make sure things are going okay and to see if you need any more support? And that really extends right through an adopted individual's lifespan, because these kind of reconnections with birth relatives, or sometimes first-time connections with birth relatives, depending on circumstances, can happen at any time in your life. And so the questioning really was about, well, if we're all saying this is potentially a good thing and we should be looking at whether we could do more of it, the question needs to be asked, like, how will that be achieved? What are the best ways to achieve this? What is currently available to support people, to support adopted people of any age that want to have direct contact with any birth relative? Because I suspected that it was patchy, and it is.
It's massively helpful data, isn't it, that you sort of dug out there. I think there's just a few of the headlines that are sort of 31% of adoptive parents had a named person at their agency who they could ask for advice or information about contact.
Yeah.
15% of adoptive parents involved in direct contacts at their agency regularly reviews the family's contact arrangements. 15%. That's not a lot, is it?
It's not a lot. And I think, excuse me, apologies for this cold. Apologies, listeners, for all the grunting. I do apologise. But I think the reality is that the picture that I suspected we'd find, and we did find, was of where direct contact is taking place, that there is often some involvement from social workers at the beginning. Often it's quite practical. You know, this is the email address you need to, this is the email address of the person, or it's setting up a meeting, or it's even sometimes coming to the first meeting, monitoring for a little while. But over the long term, it very quickly moves towards being something that's facilitated. When we talk about contact in childhood, something that's facilitated between the adoptive parents usually and either the birth relative, if it's an adult, or the parents or carers of the birth relative, with extremely little involvement. And we all know families, you know, where that's the case. And I think that's a pretty common scenario. I think the thing that most surprised me, but the thing that I really wanted to know, and it's really great doing the adoption barometer, because you can you know, you can stick these questions in, because I think it's an almost universally held belief that adopters don't want this and they won't come forward to adopt. I think it's an almost universally held belief. I've seen it said so many times, stated as if it's fact. Well, we don't have more direct contact. Nobody would want to adopt if they thought they were going to have a lot of direct contact. It'll put people off and people won't come forward. And it was really, I found it, well, hilarious almost, that when we asked people if they thought it would put prospective adopters off, they mostly said, yes, we think it will put prospective adopters off. But when we asked those same prospective adopters and adoptive parents if they were interested in doing direct contact, they were pretty much in favour of it. So prospective adopters in particular, and they're talking, I mean, it's completely theoretical. These are people who didn't have children placed with them. They're thinking about it in a total abstract. But in the abstract, the overwhelming majority of prospective adopters were open to some extent to the idea of having direct contact. In fact, when it came to the possibility of having direct and we did phrase the question, would you be open to this if it was safe? All right, so assuming there's been some risk assessment and there's been safety taken into account, there was only 11% of prospective adopters who would not who said that there were no circumstances that they would be open to contact with birth parents. So 89% would be open to contact with birth parents.
And this was an anonymous caveat survey. Supplied. Anonymous survey. All right, so that's really... What do you think, Scott? Are you surprised by that 11%?
I think that's quite progressive compared to what we thought.
Yeah.
If we think about, you know, those ideas that within recruitment, and, you know, thinking back to 2007, when that idea was even floated in our prep group, you know, well, you know, there might be, they're all, you know, all clutched their pearls and went, oh, you know, don't know how we feel about that kind of thing, because we didn't know, you know. So actually, for prospective adopters to say yes, they would, it's clearly not putting them off.
Well, I think we've got to be really clear that this is, you know, like I can't stress it enough, this is totally theoretical for these respondents. And certainly the level of enthusiasm wasn't as high among people who'd already adopted. And I think there is, you know, a certain amount. I think it's not without some caveats attached. So, they said, well, we would be open to it, but we'd feel like we'd need support, or we would feel like the child would need support, or we would feel like the birth relative would need support. So there's a lot of talk around those things. But I think, it's not an indication of... I think what it's an indication of is that there's something to work with in some initial openness. It's not a guarantee that this is a lot of prospective adopters who are fully on board with the full... But it gives you something to work with, and it really gives... It blows apart the assumption that nobody will come forward to adopt if this is a possibility, because these people clearly have come forward to adopt with this in mind.
I was recently at a meeting where the conversation sort of hung around the workforce's reluctance and a presumption, but also a reluctance and a risk aversion to get involved. And I sort of reflect on our experiences that when we adopted some of my children, that's a phrase, isn't it? Some of the kids. We asked for direct contact. It was refused. We said we're going to do it anyway, and they said, "Oh well, here's the phone number. Crack on."
Well, it's interesting because after the barometer's published, I get to have a few meetings and I get to go and do some presentations at different places, and I have had a couple of conversations with social workers about this.
Yeah.
And it's not been badly received as a concept. I mean, they weren't negative conversations, but it did focus on that. That the weight of responsibility of the social worker in managing the risk of it all and making the decisions. Because at the end of the day, especially with young children, somebody's making decisions on that child's behalf, you know, and on that family's behalf, really. And you don't know how it's going to play out. And so the responsibility for making those decisions is huge and enormous. And even among adopted adults who had direct contact during their childhood, more than half of them did say that it had been at times emotionally challenging and difficult. And we've got to acknowledge that. Yeah. And I think the other thing we have to acknowledge is the how we can create, how professionals and adoptive parents can figure out how to create an environment for the adopted child or young person that it gives them the best possible ability to be able to say what they really think and want. Because I think if you speak to adoptive parents, they would all tell you, you know, that it's fine if they're you know what I mean? We all think, and here we are, three adoptive parents on the call, and we would all say, gosh, I would be open, but we talk about it openly. And you know, you would do that. But nonetheless, it wasn't quite half, but it was going on for half of the adopted adults who had not had contact in childhood were saying that they felt it was a subject they couldn't really raise. Their parents, or their adoptive parents, would be upset or would react negatively if they raised it. And really interestingly, because I looked at it, I specifically looked at it because I wanted to know, there was no difference between people adopted 50 years ago and people adopted 20 years ago in terms of that. So even since there's been a little bit more openness towards the possibility of contact, still a similar proportion of more recently adopted adults were saying that they didn't feel they could raise these subjects at home because of the upset it would cause to adoptive parents. So this is something else that some social workers, conversations I've had with social workers along the lines of, well, but when we ask an adopted young person, what do they want? You know, there's all this complication to take into account in terms of what they might say, what they might feel able to say.
That's a hard one.
I remember we spoke to, the name escapes me, an adopted young person. She's in her early 20s, and she raised this very issue. She said, and it wasn't that she felt that the parents were putting pressure on her adoptive parents. It felt that she just felt disloyal in doing it. And so even though they were saying, hey, go and do it, it didn't change how she intrinsically felt as being disloyal. And so the adoptive parents might sort of think, oh yeah, we created an environment where she could do what she wanted, but that doesn't change how she felt. And you know, she got over it, but it really made me think about the conversation that I was having with my adult children, sort of saying, yeah, go and do it, but then seeing them feeling
emotionally turmoil about it.
Yeah,
and I think there may be a case for trying to find out whether normalizing direct contact relationships from the beginning of someone being adopted sort of mitigates against that, because then it's what you've always known. So most of the time when we're talking to adopted adults about their experiences of contacting birth relatives or being in contact with birth relatives, it's happening after a long period of not being in contact with them. So it's introducing a new thing into the dynamic, and it's more difficult. And we didn't capture it well in the barometer. We didn't really capture it at all in the barometer. The dynamic how it would be different if an adopted adult had some direct contact throughout their childhood, and whether that might, you know, change that dynamic and change that emotional burden, really, of trying to be pleasing everybody and feeling responsible for everybody's feelings. But I think the change towards more acceptable or more accepted direct contact is so recent that we don't necessarily have a big pool of adopted adults to ask about that yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I keep asking questions, so I talk over Scott. All over.
Always. This is just standard, is it not? It's standard when it's a report, because you know that I'm not very great with reading. Unless there's pictures.
Could you do like a pop-up version next week?
Yeah, can you do like a brain injury version for him? I'm trying to find what I was looking for now. Yeah, because there was a recommendation about the National Contact Service. I'm just trying to find that.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there it is. Yeah. And each nation as well, which is kind of useful. So what's that?
Yeah, I think the basic idea, I guess, and I'm not guessing because it was my suggestion. So I fully know what I was thinking when I said, can we put this in? I think this would be great. I think what we get back is basically it's a patchwork of what's available for families with young children and for adopted individuals right through the entire lifespan. It depends where you were adopted. It depends when you were adopted. It depends who you phone up and ask for help. Some people might be offered a great peer support group. Most people are not. Some people are offered really good attuned adoption counselling. Most people are not. You know, some people are paying hundreds and hundreds of pounds for mediation. Some people are not. So I mean, the number of people. So we did get people coming back to us when we were talking about tracing or looking for birth relatives as an adult. We did get a number coming back and saying, I had this brilliant support worker who really helped me. I had great counselling. We did get a few people saying that, but we got more people saying, what support? There was no support. I did it on my own. There was nothing. Yeah. And for me, there's a problem. There is a problem in how we manage contact, both when adopted people are children and when they're adults. And it's the same adopted people that are needing support all the way through this. So for a start, there's a weird thing where if you're an adult, you've got to go to children's services and ask for your files and admin. That's weird. Yeah. That comes over as being strange. Yeah. So it's about whether we can have national frameworks for supporting these things that are, I would say cradle to grave, but it's not really an appropriate term, is it? But you know what I mean? For the lifespan, so that this is the service that you go to. These are the mediation is free, the counselling is free, and you can get it whenever. I mean, obviously, I like to make recommendations that are if money was unlimited and if pigs could fly and all of that. But at any point in your life as an adopted person, this is a one-stop place for any and all needs you have regarding your records, your birth family, your life history, and the counselling you might need around that, or the support. And this was specifically about looking at contact. So there are a lot of other areas of concern for adopted adults in terms of the therapeutic services that are available or not available and the kind of support that's available. Yeah. And that is a whole other issue that also needs looking at. But this was specifically to do with contact. Mm. And obviously there's in many ways it has to be delivered locally, but at the very least, could we have a national service with national guidelines that everybody got to follow on, and a kind of, I mean, I think there might be something to be said for, I didn't, this is not in the report, this is just me, but I think there might be something to be said for it being done by someone that isn't social services.
Well,
thought that through.
I was just thinking that point there. If you're talking about a national service, I mean, we know in our experience as adopters and from listening to other parents as well, that, the kind of the resource and capacity of teams within regional adoption agencies and local authorities and voluntary agencies to have to deal with the addition of something that's potentially quite new. It's not new, but it could be quite new to some to have to do. I mean, for that responsibility to sit there and to be funded within an adoption team or an adoption support team, that's a big kind of pressure, isn't it, on something that's already quite stretched. So, to get it right for each child individually, because we're not talking about just we're not talking about everybody having the same setup, are we? We're talking about, I would be different to Al, would be different to your kids. It would look very differently for each family, and that's a massive undertaking, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'll hold my hands up if people want to say, well, you've not really gone into the detail of how that would actually work. You know what I mean? Well, and I haven't. But one of the reasons I haven't is because I'm not adopted. So I don't, why would I know how it should, you know what I mean? So this is where it's not really, in terms of what the design and the delivery of these kinds of services are going to be, that's not for me to decide when I'm writing a recommendation in Adoption Barometer. The last thing you want is Becky Brooks in charge of adoption policy for the whole UK. This is absolutely not. But just like, it's a starter for 10. What if we had this? What if we looked at the possibility of this? How might that work?
Yeah.
Mm. Is it something to think about? Can we get, so this is another recommendation of the report, can we get proper advisory boards of adopted people who are able then to actually influence the design and delivery of services for adopted people. You can absolutely say, well, that's a really half-baked that recommendation doesn't really explain, doesn't really tell that. Well, no, it doesn't. But the point is that the design and delivery of this would have to be informed by those with lived experience of it. And there would be an element of adoptive parents needing to contribute, because when our children are young, it's often us that are managing these conversations.
Yeah.
But adopted people are frankly adults for a lot longer than they are children. So that's a big chunk that isn't being addressed if we're not if we're not listening to, and if we're not given opportunities, if we're not providing space for that.
And there's also an element of what the input from foster carers as well in this, isn't there? Because, you know, a few stories I know and my own personal experiences that, you know, contact, direct contact was very hard. But when, you know, when do you embrace that and say, okay, so when are we going to try again? You know, is it up to the young person? Is it up to somebody to come in and assess what the, how do they assess it? All that sort of stuff. So there's lots of stuff in there.
It's interesting because I chatted to someone, if you, it's an upcoming podcast from a kinship grandparent. And she was saying she's doing a PhD in contact in kinship. And she said the court ordered there must be contact. And that was it. It was like, full stop, crack on. And she said, it's such a complicated issue. And you think that it's not, we're not talking about 5,000 people, are we? We're talking about tens and hundreds of thousands of people who, this is a massive part of their lives. And is there a service that can hold expertise and knowledge and help people?
Yeah.
And so can I draw you off this? Because this is, I mean, this is a well-worn path for us. We talk about this all the time. You know, the contact thing, I think it's very current, isn't it? But it's really important for people. There's a few other things that I wanted to kind of bring up from the barometer. So here we go. this is like very exciting.
I know, he could say anything now.
I literally could say
He's numbered them all, put them into a fishbowl.
Yeah, I'm kind of stressed that you've got the barometer in front of you and I haven't.
Right, okay. Point, paragraph three, no.
page 92.
92, you said. Approvals and matching process. I was really surprised to say that you've put there a set of national timescales for preparation and approval. Don't we have national timescales?
The adoption barometer is a UK-wide barometer. So anywhere where it says national this, and you think, we've already got that, it's possible that in another nation they don't have that. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying in every other nation they don't have that. So there are a few things like that on the recommendations. There are things around education, like, you know, saying like a fund, like funding, and like obviously in England that would be pupil premium. Yeah. And the other nations have some, Wales has a thing and Scotland have a thing, but it's not really. So yeah, there's a few places where that'll be the issue.
All right, cool. I'll let you off that one. Okay, you get a pass on that one.
I was going to tell you off for thinking this was just for England, Al, actually.
I know, right? How England-centric of you, Al.
I know. I mean, everyone would think you were just English or something, you know?
I feel totally on very thin ice and uncertain what to say next. That doesn't involve me losing my registration. I'm English and I'm proud. Ooh, that sounds awful.
That sounds very bad.
Oh, my goodness.
Say something about the football. You're on safe ground with the football.
Oh, yes, yes.
Women's football, say that.
Ooh. Women's football.
I never watched football. I watched the women's football.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know, and this is really, I know this is really off topic, but I watched the football and then I watched some of the, and like, I'll be really honest because my family are kind of quite into football. All the women, none of the men are remotely interested in football, but all the women, my sister in particular, my mum, are incredible, huge football fans. And so I've always watched men's football. And when women's football started to get a bit more traction, I was a bit like, you know, I've kind of struggled to get into it. Just you're not familiar with the players and you don't have the tribal sort of thing driving you to do it. But I've really enjoyed the Euros. I think it'll be a real turning point. But they showed some footage of the public park where they were all watching it in Sheffield on the news, and they won the match, and the footage just was of all the crowd cheering, but right at the forefront of the picture was about six boys, I would say aged between 10 and 14, like jumping around, cheering, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but I almost, I could have cried right there and then, because when I was at school, back in the 80s, there was no question that girls would play football. Yeah. I mean, you would have been humiliated with derisory mockery, okay, at the mere suggestion that you might want to play football. Football wasn't available as part of our PE. There was absolutely no football. It was not doable.
Yeah.
And those boys in the 80s, and perhaps even more recently, would have mocked and laughed at you mercilessly if you'd have even come near. In fact, at my primary school, there were two, it was an old Victorian school, there were two outside yards. One was for the junior boys to play football in, and the other same size yard was for the whole rest of the school. So we had like all these children crammed onto this yard, you couldn't run about. And then in this other yard, there's these like, I don't know, about 80 boys got the whole yard for themselves playing football in. That's how things have changed. So I know it's completely off topic.
Yeah, no,
it absolutely warmed the cockles of my heart.
While we're on that topic, I had to calm a 16-year-old down who thought that it was just common knowledge that women should play football. And trying to explain to him that that's not always been the case, and him getting really antsy about it, believe me. And he gets antsy about the tiniest little thing in the minute, because he's 16 tomorrow and he knows everything. So I think that's, you know, those boys that you talk about would be roughly within that age range. And I think they've just grown up, seen it, and thought, this has always happened.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's a dark history as well, women's football. You know, they're literally making up medical evidence to say that it's going to kill women if they play football. Literally. You know, it'll disrupt their wombs and things, all kinds of madness.
Well, that kind of thing's been said about so many things that women have wanted to do.
If only they'd maybe thought about looking into, you know, men heading the ball and all that sort of stuff, you know, rather than whether it was going to affect the female's womb, you know.
Well,
tangentially related point, at least, you know, society can change, can't it? This is what we're talking about.
Yep.
Some of what we're talking about this evening. Boom.
And there was a few other things. Was there anything in there that, I always ask you this question, like, is there anything in there that came out and you went, oh, I was not expecting that?
There were a couple of things. And normally I say, no, nothing surprised me. No, I normally say that, yeah. The main one that I've already mentioned was the openness towards direct contact from prospective adopters that really got me going.
Can I say with that one, as I thought about it, because I've heard that being quoted a few times, I've been in meetings where people have gone, yeah, and this is what they say, but I never clicked that it was anonymous. And I thought that, because I thought, oh, they're asking people and people are giving the right answer. But if it's anonymous, that is really encouraging. It's a different
statistic. I mean, they might be trying. I mean, what? It's a self-selecting survey. Also, we've got to be realistic about what the results mean and don't mean. This is not peer-reviewed.
Well, don't undermine your barometer.
But having said that, ruin the...
we
ask a lot of people.
Al, does that mean you didn't complete the barometer this year?
I've boycotted the barometer, and you know why, Scott. I boycotted the barometer because I was outed in public about...
Oh, yes, you are, because of your hundreds of children. Yes, that's true. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Do you not know Becky?
Was it me?
No,
it was... Or maybe the first barometer, someone said... I got a tweet that said, oh, we've had to change the drop-down boxes for number of children for Al Coates. And I thought, so if whatever I put in, they're going to know it is, aren't they?
You know, I can tell you.
Not now.
Because
not
I crunched the numbers. You'd be amazed how many people need to use the fifth and sixth box.
I don't doubt it. I like to think I'm not special in any single way, but...
No.
He did
bless you. Well, you could safely anonymously fill it in now. There'd be no way. To be honest, I'll be really honest. It's me. I'm the only person that looks at the original survey data. Nobody else looks at it. And I don't really look at it. I mean, I don't... Do you know what I mean? I've got no... Because there's like 2,500 responses. It's just a lot of numbers to me. You could, theoretically, look at an individual response and look at everything they've put, but there are 2,500 responses. And other than that, once I've transferred the numbers to my spreadsheet, you can't track along if the same person that said this also said that. It's not possible to do it. Yeah. The only reason exhausting. I ever look into individual responses is if people have said they were willing to be a case study, and then I'll pick a few out to look. So yeah, it is. Yeah, it's great. I really like doing it. But yeah, I'm not. I guess people would think I'd really know a lot about them because they filled the barometer in. But it, I mean, I really, it's not how it goes at all. Yeah.
It's not how you rule.
But anyway, things that surprised me. Prospective adopters. I was quite surprised that prospective adopters were quite grumpy this year compared to last year. Prospective adopters last year were hugely, just gushingly and overwhelmingly positive. And prospective adopters usually are pretty positive about the processes they've been through. I think, and this is not to suggest that they don't know their own minds, but it is just to suggest that later on, you might reflect back on your adoption approvals process with a slightly different viewpoint. But at the time that they're going through it, they're mostly very happy with it. But they weren't as happy in 2021 as they had been in 2020. And in fact, more of them thought that COVID was a big problem in 2021 than had thought that in 2020, which is almost, I mean, we're kind of the other end of it now and you sort of forget. But actually, during 2021, there was still a lot of COVID stuff going on.
Yeah.
And it was really like random COVID stuff. So it was normal. Yeah. You know, in 2020, it was like, we're all in lockdown. We're all in this together. We're all doing this thing. But by 2021, it was like, well, you're in lockdown. You're not. You've got to go back to work. Yeah. You should stay at home. You know, and I think there was an awful lot of people going back to work and then massive amounts of sickness and self-isolating. And it just really was disruptive for the workforce. And people found that really difficult.
Ask about that then, because I wonder whether, because we know that there's probably a really high number of people who are approved and there's a lower number of children waiting, isn't there? With that is it the last 3-4 quarters? Does that then maybe reflect that people are sort of waiting longer and a bit hacked off?
Possibly, but I'm not seeing massive amounts of barometer data is not giving me that matching the matching time.
Right.
Is hugely increasing, to be honest.
Right.
I could look at it because it, I can't tell you what it is, but it hasn't at any point jumped out to me as being a big thing that I should pay attention to. So I can't say what it is, but yeah. No, when we go and look at the responses from people who've said they had a horrible time during approvals and matching, what's a really common feature across all of them is changes of staff. Either they found the relationship with their social worker difficult or they had frequent changes of staff, which quite often seem to result in the paperwork is lost. You know, you've got to do your medical again. Oh, we've run it. Oh, like we've gone past the deadline for that paperwork applying. So now we'll have to do this check again. Mm. So a lot of that stuff going on. And I think we did look a bit more closely at matching this time because we've had some feedback. Just saying, like, there's not a lot of questions about matching, and we find it quite difficult. You know, some people find it quite a difficult time. I think partly because, you know, it's really intense, isn't it? The approvals process and the meetings and the training and all that. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's your link maker access. See you. Bye. You know, people feel really cut adrift when it comes to the matching stages. So we asked a few extra questions about that. But I don't remember anything leaping out at me saying that matching was taking a lot longer than it previously had done, to be honest.
Again, I can't remember where I was, but I think it was maybe Sarah Jahal was saying how there's some evidence to suggest that when people sort of get knocked back a few times, it starts to be sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. People look that they've applied and knocked back, applied and knocked back, and then the next social worker goes, oh, there must be something, and it's often not. It's just that, and so it must be a pretty awful period of time.
I'd not thought of that, but yeah, not having used those services myself, I'm not fully on board with how they exactly work. But I mean, if they can see that kind of information, this person's expressed an interest in 6 or 7 profiles and been knocked back. Yeah, I mean, it could, couldn't it?
Yeah, you'd have to dig deeper, wouldn't you? And people maybe don't have the time to dig deeper. That's maybe...
It's like having a gap on your CV, isn't it?
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Don't talk to Scott about his gaps.
Shut up. I don't have any gaps. No, that is interesting, Di, because you can just imagine if you spend the time as a couple or as an individual, even spending hours filling in forms that are lost or out of date or whatever, that must be hugely frustrating, especially when you think, okay, I'm past that stage now, I've done that. You know, that's just ridiculous, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think there are as well, I mean, I know there's always the thing where people say, oh, it's very invasive or it's very this or that. We actually get fairly few and we get a lot of comments. So, you know, I do give space for people to, you know, anything else you want to tell us about your experience. You know, and we usually get like 1,000, like several hundred comments, which I kind of go through and that takes some time. And we don't get an awful lot of people just going too invasive and that's it.
Yeah.
But you do sometimes get some really compelling individual stories of of where you think, oh, that could have been, I can see why that felt very invasive to you. Mm. And actually, perhaps with just a little bit of sensitivity, could have been handled in a way that was a bit less, you know, things around medical history, things around relationship history. You know, not everyone's relationship history is something that it's healthy for them to go delving back into, to be totally honest. And I think you do get a sense from some comments that people, that it, oftentimes it's okay in the end, but they have a long period of being very worried and stressed about it before it's made clear to them that the thing they most fear that the social workers will say or do isn't going to be said or done. Sometimes it doesn't work out okay in the end. But, you know, you do see people going through these periods of stress because they're terribly worried that the social worker will contact a person that shouldn't, you know, that it would not be healthy to contact again. Or I'm trying not to go into any specific details for fear of trashing anyone's anonymity. But there are a couple of examples in the report of that.
Well, I'm on a few Facebook groups and you see that really regularly. People going, look, 22 years ago, I was married to a man for 6 weeks and he was a psychopath. And I know for a fact he'll put a hole in any plans I've got. Do I have to put him on the form? And I go, oh no, I don't want to see that. So I usually go and hide in the corner. But but you can understand the anxiety because people are thinking this is historic stuff and it's going to go nowhere. And if that's self-reporting, of course, they could be another version of events. But
yeah, and social workers have got to obviously look at these things in the round, haven't they? But I'm interested when we had more respondents than ever before this year say that there were times when the process seemed so difficult they wondered if they could continue. And I'm beginning to be more interested, and I think this is a conversation. Funnily enough, we had a meeting the other day talking about like evaluating how the things that we'd done this year in the barometer. One of the things that I was saying at the meeting was there have been 4 years now for the barometer to say, to point out things that we perhaps didn't know before. I'm beginning to be as interested in understanding more now about why those things are things. Now we've established that those are not anomalies, that every year around half of respondents say they find the process so difficult, they wonder if they can continue. I'm interested more and more now in understanding more about why that is, you know. And it's difficult because the barometer is massive and there's 200 and odd questions and it's this war and peace epic that I produce. And I sort of get, I mean, honestly, guys, if you're out there and you've gone, I just can't read it, it's just too long. I really understand. Okay. I really understand because it is very long and it's really dense. Like, there's loads in it. You know, it's really a thing to just flick through and like pick out the bits that look like they might be interesting to you particularly. So I get that, and I don't know how much space there is in the barometer to put these things in, but I want to know more about that 50-odd% who say it seems so difficult, they wonder if they can continue. And some of them are in this category of people with these, you know, genuine fears, about what's going to be uncovered. Yeah. What's going to be not uncovered, that says like they're hiding something, but you know, things that are going to be stirred up, I guess.
I guess you've got to be able to catch those people as well, haven't you? So if you're asking and after they've had the experience, or if they're kind of partway through the experience, then that's difficult to catch them at that point.
Because I do form F assessments, which are the fostering assessments, and there's a real dance you do with an applicant, is you want to create an environment where people can feel they can say anything to you. But you've got to build trust so that people know you're not going to kind of freak out and overreact, that people want a reasonable response that's pragmatic and... that, you know, from my point of view, I've got to be thorough. I've got to get to the bottom of things. I've got to unpick everything. And then as long as I can tie it all back up together again, it's fine. But you can see if then you've got added into that the bureaucratic challenges. If you've got changeover of workforce, paperwork lost, you're going to go, if I open this can of worms, no one ever going to get a lid on it. Or I don't trust that they'll deal with this proportionately or responsibly or, you know, or thoroughly or whatever, you know, whatever. But that does hint towards something we weren't going to talk about, doesn't it? About Leyland, which is for another podcast we'll probably do in a few weeks or something. But I think that we'll get some assessing social workers on. That was a really downbeat note to finish on, wasn't it?
Well, let's not finish. Like, don't finish with that.
Oh, I thought you were going to the pie and peas supper.
You wait, pie and peas. I wish it was a pie and peas, but no, I haven't
been to a pie and peas supper in years.
No, do you know what? And maybe this, and this is a terrible northern sort of thing, but I sort of pine for the 90s. Most of my friends got married in the 90s, right? Because that's the age I am. It was only me that waited until I was like virtually an old age pensioner. And all my friends that got married in the 90s, almost without exception, had a potato pie supper for the evening do. Honestly, you never get a good potato pie supper these days.
I don't even know what that is, to be honest.
Scott's like,
meat and potato pie.
Meat and potato pie.
Mushy peas, red cabbage.
But you have to remember, I'm Scottish, so our pies are very different up in Scotland. You know, we've got like bean and tatty pies, or mince pies, or macaroni pies. There's a range.
When you say macaroni pies, are we talking about pasta?
Yes.
Okay, I'll be honest. It's the most delicious thing.
Yeah, with a bit of ketchup
on it. I'm on board for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
Mm-hmm.
You've blown my mind, but a meat and potato pie. Oh.
Yeah, so that's like bean and potato pie.
It's like minced.
Yeah.
Yeah,
minced meat, I guess, beef.
Yeah.
I don't know, you don't really care. But you're at the evening do, you're having a good old boogie on the dance floor with the DJ playing the whatever and the loud music and that, and then this smell, and then the emergency exit doors of the Catholic Club Hall open up, and in comes a guy with a trolley carrying big, you know, like silver foil cartons, and they rip the lid off, and it's steaming pastry. And meat and potato pie underneath. And then you all queue up with your plates and you get a big serving dollops on your plate.
Right.
That was a possibly quite working class wedding in the north in the 90s.
I had pie and mash in London. After years of going to London, I had pie and mash. And it was like, I was expecting it to be something quite spectacular. And it was the most average pie with mashed potato. It was a rubbish pie with mashed potato.
Maybe you went to a bad place.
And well, and it had liquor on, and liquor is just green gravy. It was like, this is just pie and mash.
Somebody and told me that liquor is just like snot. It looks like snot.
It's parsley gravy, that's all.
Okay, I feel like I'm going to be challenged here, because when I'm able to, I'm going to go to Scotland before I go to Isles, and I'm going to take him a bean and tatty pie and see what he thinks of that. And he can review it.
I'll listen in. Yeah. For a pie review.
Well, if there's a pie review episode, we're all coming in and we're all bringing our favourite pie.
Trail ahead of time and I'll be right there.
Yeah, we know she'll listen to that one because it's got a pie.
Pies in it. We took the family to London the other week. We didn't try the pie and mash.
Oh.
Just even the thought of it.
It's just a joke, man. Honestly, go to Greg's, get yourself a meat and potato slice. For champion.
People scoff at Greg's, but I like a Greg's.
I love a Greg's.
Chicken bake.
Oh, Greg's app. Yeah. Get the Greg's app.
Yum yums, it's your. I have to be restrained around a box of yum yums.
The Greg's app. On your birthday, they send you a treat for free. Get the Greg's app.
I'm getting it.
She's got it. Honestly, she's more than now.
I
got my kids into it. My kids were like hysterical. They kept changing their birthdays trying to get more free treats. And they opened I live in the rural countryside, but they opened a Greggs in the local industrial estate, and that was our local. It won Greggs of the Northeast Greggs of the Year award. It's like,
I did wonder when you say you've had your Greggs or whatever it is in the morning. I'm like, where has he gone?
Where's he going to Greggs?
Now I know.
Yeah. And they even, I shouldn't say this, they even offered to give my dogs like just sausages. Like, I'll give the dog sausages. And then the dog, I've told you, my dogs ran into Greggs. It was chaos to Alsatians in Greggs. It was all fine.
That's hilarious.
I'm aware you've got to be at a meeting. I'm slightly worried that you don't know who the new CEO is of Adoption UK. So next time you go there, you'll be having a yak on with someone going, who's the new tea boy? And it turns out
I have virtually met it's her. It's a lady.
Ooh.
Have virtually met her because she did. She was able to come to a full staff meeting and say hello to us all. But she's not. Just to, people have notices and stuff. I didn't really ask, to be honest. I'm not very curious. Your problem here is that I'm very curious about how many prospective adopters, X, Y, and Z. I'm not very curious about anything else. So, If I was more curious, I could probably dish some more information, but no.
To be fair, though, Becky, it's quite a big role. It's not like just, you know, they're taking over a shop on the high street, is it? So, you know, no. These sorts of things have to be, all the ducks need to be in a row. And if they've been approached to apply for the role, maybe, you know, all that sort of stuff. So there's loads of stuff to consider when they're going to announce something like this, isn't there? So, you know.
I'm sure it'll be announced at some point.
And it's been quite a turbulent love. I mean, from Adopting UK's point of view, I think it's been quite a turbulent love, hasn't it? There's been lots of to and fro in, and you've lost someone, and then there was the whole hoo-ha last autumn about the thing. I'm vague. I should run a podcast and be full of information. So it feels like it's an adoption is a bit of a flux. You know, the care reviews come out, and it's not front and centre, is it? So there's a job to do.
There's a job to do. I'm not sure that the job is to make adoption front and centre of the care reviews, to be totally honest. I mean, it's, you know, I would personally would have liked to see a little bit more mention of adoption in the care review, but I think there are, you know, it's a big review, isn't it? There's covering a lot of things. I think there have been changes afoot for a while, haven't there? You know, special guardianship orders are at a similar rate to adoption orders now. We see that. So we see that there were changes afoot. And I think there is a welcome move of listening more and platforming more voices of people with lived experience. Care experience people. So not just in adoption, everywhere. Everywhere I'm seeing this. In organisations, and not just, you know, about mental health organisations. And I was reading a thing today on Twitter about research with people with lived experience of criminal justice system. So I think in all areas, everywhere, people are looking more and more to platform the voices of those with lived experience in various different ways. So changes afoot generally, really. And yes, there's been definitely a time of change at Adoption UK, most obviously. You know, you've seen, as we've discussed, you know, the CEO changing. We've got new trustees on board. We've got the lovely Anne heading up, looking at, you know, the whole area of adopted adults and the way that you can work with adopted adults. Because, as you know, Anne is an adopted adult also. So there are various different things sort of going on, and I think change is afoot generally in the sector, isn't it? And I think an organisation that doesn't change probably just rolls over and dies, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
excellent. Absolutely. It's been lovely having you on.
Yes, it has.
It's been lovely to see you. Excellent. Oh, I said that in a really doubtful way. It's because I started the sentence and I wasn't sure how it was going to end. It has been lovely to see you. Say excellent. It like you mean it.
Oh, yeah, I sounded quite patronising myself, but the
do apologise. Awkward. There was a weird. Yeah. There were noises off as well. You know when sometimes you're speaking and then you hear a little noise and you get slightly distracted. You might not do that, but I do it all the time. Heard a little noise and it made my brain slow down. What's that noise? What are they doing?
That's so much fun.
Yeah. Well, it has been a pleasure to have you on again, and we're just sorry we couldn't have John for longer like we normally do, but we understand you've got to mean. So, good luck with the new role as CEO of Adoption UK, Becky. We're sure you're going to be amazing at it.
Yeah. I can't, honestly. The thought kills me to the very bone. I have had a conversation recently where it's like,
denied it.
We could do with more people working on XYZ. Maybe, Becky, you could manage a small team of people doing XYZ. No, I couldn't.
Good, but badly.
This is not my skill set, managing people, because let's face it, I already don't know anybody's name in this conversation. So it's really hard to have that kind of welfare of your staff. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's just, I'd be a terrible manager. Good grief. I can't think of anything worse.
Imagine, I'm very happy. Imagine Becky's team meetings. So just tell me your names again.
Tell me who you are again. What do you do?
Don't take this the wrong way. But
I've forgotten who you are.
Oh, dearie me. Wow.
Well, on that
not quite as bad as that, but I... No. Oh, dear, no. I know my strengths, and my strengths are kitchen table related.
Take on that what you will, people.
And on that bombshell.
Yeah. Say good night.
Good night, Becky.
Bye, guys.
Don't go anywhere, Becky, because I've got a question to ask you.